Color it isn't our fault. Color it isn't our fault that the windows are this small.
All right.
I have just learned that our time is very, very limited here. There is a bridge club that's going to meet here at 7:30, which gives them about 8 minutes, and that isn't enough. So let's make it 7:45. One of the advantages of my job is being able to, from time to time, introducing distinguished individuals from the areas in which we travel when I'm working as a travel escort. And tonight is no exception. The University of Alaska, which we visited this afternoon, is quite a school. And the senior professor at the University of Alaska has consented to tell us something tonight about Alaska. He is not only an historian, you notice I'm putting that first, he is also a professor of mathematics. So you can be sure that there will be no mathematical errors in his talk. At this time, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. William Cashin, who is president of the Tanana, and I hope I pronounced that right, Yukon Historical Society.
Thank you, Mr. Grahn, and Mrs. Larimore, members of the Minnesota Historical Society. After teaching school now for nigh on 33 years, a little noise doesn't bother me. So if you want to keep on eating your dinner while I make a few remarks, go right ahead. First of all, greetings from the Tanana Yukon Historical Society. And secondly, my apologies about the weather. Had you been here in mid-June, when we had the heat wave, I'm sure you'd have joined us in praying for cold weather. Then in early July, when the smoke was covering the whole valley and most of our forest in the hinterland was burning up, we prayed for rain. And so I apologize that we probably overdid it a little bit. I thought, if time permitted, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about the history of Fairbanks. I'm not a native of this town. I was born and raised down in Douglas, which is the little town across from Juneau. But I moved up here as a freshman student at the university in 1933, and this is my adopted home, and so I feel somewhat of an authority since those years on. But the fascinating part of Fairbanks history to me is the early days, and especially the founding. You see, Fairbanks was founded by chance and not by choice. It came about through the kind of meeting of three different individuals from different walks of life. A prospector by the name of Felix Pedro, a trader by the name of E.T. Barnett, and a federal judge by the name of James Wickersham. I'm sure you've seen and will hear, if you haven't already heard, the name of Wickersham throughout Alaska. He's one of those great individuals who projects himself upon the scene, probably much larger than life. It happened back in 1902. That's the date we claim as our founding date. Felix Pedro, an Italian prospector, Italian by birth, one of the 100 or so prospectors in this middle part of Alaska, gold having been discovered over in Yukon Territory in Dawson, gold having already been discovered in the far reaches of Nome on the beaches, and so many prospectors thought they'd better look someplace in between. And so there were probably 100 or more professional prospectors up and down the Yukon River, into the streams and byways, with their gold pans, seeing if they could get color. Felix Pedro was one of those. He came over from the Circle country and was prospecting here in 1901. Barnett was a trader. He was one of those adventurous sort. Ever since the purchase of Alaska, these traders would get together a few staples and supplies, get themselves a boat, and cruise the rivers to trade with the natives for their furs, changing and exchanging in their place a few guns, ammunition, blankets, flour, rice, some of the staples. So he got the idea of establishing a trading post in the upper reaches of the Tanana River. Actually, he was headed for Tanana Crossing, which is the place about midway between Valdez and Eagle. And Eagle is the town on the Yukon River right alongside the Canadian border. And that was the trail into the interior in those days during the gold rush. And he expected to make a trading post over at Tanana Crossing. But in order to get his supplies there, he had to come up to the Yukon River and into the Tanana and try to proceed up the river. He chartered a boat by the name of the Lavelle Young, under the command of a Captain Adams, under the agreement that Adams would take him as far up as he possibly could, because no one had really taken a boat of that size that far up the Tanana. And so, as it turned out, when they got down here to the Bates Rapids, just a few miles below here, they couldn't get through. But Adams had heard that by coming through the Chena Slough, that he could bypass these rapids and finally connect again with the Tanana and go on to his destination. Well, that didn't turn out to be the case. He came up the Chena Slough about as far as he could go, and finally he could go no further. He was a mile or so above town here, and under terms of the agreement, he was to throw off the supplies and the trade goods on the bank and turn around and go home and leave Barnett there. Barnett persuaded him to go back a little bit to an embankment where there were some trees, and so he did, and unloaded the supplies about where the NC Company is now, just down a block from here. Well, let's see how they all got together. Pedro, in the meantime, had seen the smoke of the vessel. He'd come over the hill. He hated to think of going 140 miles back to Circle in order to get supplies. When he found out that supplies were being loaded on the bank of the Chena right here, he was delighted. He said he'd spread the word among the other prospectors, and he himself purchased supplies and went back to the hills for more prospecting. Then Barnett settled down for the winter, deciding that the best thing for him to do would be to winter it here with what supplies he had, trade a little bit with the Indians that were around, then to continue his plan the next year. And he actually did. He and Mrs. Barnett, incidentally Barnett's wife was with him, and three partners. And they went overland to Valdez, hiked out in March with the furs that they had and traded, went on to Seattle, got more supplies, got a new boat, knocked down of course, shipped it up to the mouth of the Yukon River, and built the new boat called the Isabel, and proceeded on up the river, ostensibly and with the purpose, in fact, of picking up his supplies and continuing on up to Tanana Crossing. But by the time he got back, Pedro had discovered gold on the 22nd of July, 1902, And the word had spread like wildfire on up the river and on down the river, and pretty soon the gold rush started. When Barnett came back expecting to load his supplies and move on, most of the supplies were used up. He took his new supplies and put them in stock, and they decided that this was the place maybe he'd better open his trading post, because gold had been discovered. Now, Wickersham was a judge that came up and had been assigned to the court in Eagle, which was the interior city at that time, it being the port of entry from Canada. And he had gone to Nome to settle some of the squabble they had on mining claims over there, as you recall. And on the way to Nome one time, he ran into Barnett, and Barnett had told him his plans of a trading post. And he said, "I tell you, if you establish a trading post, I wish you'd name it after Charles Fairbanks. He's the senator from Indiana, good friend of mine, and member of the Alaska Yukon Commission, Boundary Commission." And Barnett said he would. And so when it came to naming the town, Barnett remembered his conversation with Wickersham and decided that it would be named Fairbanks in honor of Senator Charles Fairbanks of Indiana, who incidentally later became vice president, you remember, under Theodore Roosevelt. Wickersham did one other good thing. When he got here, the word came from Washington that this was the activity, this is where the court should be. When Wickersham got to the area, Chena City, here 7 miles distant, had already a telegraph station and really a better landing spot for riverboats. And so it seemed the logical place to establish the city for this area, open the recorder's office, and conduct his court. But a couple of things happened there. In the first place, some of the people at Chena placed an exorbitant price on the piece of property he wanted to build his courthouse. And secondly, another story is that they were a rather uncomplimentary lot to one of the one of the trading boats that came through and was having trouble out in front of Chena City, and some of the local yokel, I suppose, were casting disparaging remarks upon the seamanship of the riverboat captain, and he just determined that he wasn't going to stop there, and he unloaded half of his load on the shore and took half of it up to Fairbanks and came back and got the other half and then took it up. So it doesn't pay to be impolite, I guess. Well, at any rate, Wickersham decided that because Barnett offered him a free lot where the post office is now, that he'd establish his court here. And so Fairbanks was established as the center then for this big mining activity that was going on right in 1902 and so on. That's the founding, and so we have three fathers, the Wickersham, Pedro, and Barnett. Fairbanks boomed then. Several towns were built up along the creeks, the Fox and Chattanooga and Clary, several others. A little railroad spur was built from town on up to supply the creeks. I think at one time there must have been 20,000 or more people in the area during the height of this mining season around 1907 or thereabouts. Gradually, the better paying ground was worked out. Many of them picked up what stakes they made and moved out to the United States again. And Fairbanks kind of settled down to a quiet little town, depending, of course, on its seasonal activity of mining. Transportation, of course, was always the big problem, and not only during the summer they had the river that transportation down from Dawson or up from the Nome area, St. Michael, but during the winter for 8 months it was pretty well closed off except the hard trek and trail all the way overland to Valdez, which took 7 days, by the way, after they got the horse-drawn sleds and wagons going. It took 23 days for a man to walk the distance. But Fairbanks didn't completely decline. although it kind of settled down to a little community of perhaps 2,000 during those leaner years, the war came along, the First World War, and really was the first blow. Many of the young men and the ambitious and strong and healthy young men were taken into the army and they were drafted, and they left and never came back. And so World War I was a little bit of a blow to the interior of Alaska. But there were some hopeful signs. One was the building of the Alaska Railroad, which took place from 1914 till 1923. And this, of course, gave the communication and the transportation that was needed. About the same time, the Little Alaska Agricultural College was started back on College Hill out here. 1922, six students showed up for registration the first day. Six faculty members were on hand to greet them, they tell me. I was not one of them, but it's our favorite story. And as you see now, it's quite a thriving institution. Our enrollment this year is expected at 2,500. Well, with the railroad at last and the university, or the Alaska College as it was called in those days, well on its way, although mining had been fairly well depleted for the man with the pick and shovel, still there was gold in the ground. And a large company by the name of the Fairbanks Exploration Company, the local name, came in, bought up the ground, and were able then by the use of these large dredges to make a pay. And so for the next 20 years or so, the Fairbanks Exploration Company was the basis for the economy of the interior. The 30s rolled around, and with it, of course, came the airplane, and this was just the country that the airplane was built for. With the vast distances and the lack of surface transportation, the airplane fell into a natural right here, and we grabbed it up fast. Pretty soon, everything was going by air that could possibly be loaded aboard one of the little airplanes. Communications was rather sad, perhaps, although we always had the telegraph all the way from the 1906 or 7, we had a telegraph. But Fairbanks was a quiet little community when I came in 1933. Finally, we got a radio station in 1938, and belatedly, the United States government recognized that the interior of Alaska was a very strategic place to perhaps put some defense. We were too far away from another major war, and they finally, the government, the Air Corps, put in a little test station known as Ladd Field, which has now been changed and known as Fort Wayne. But with the advent of war in 1941, we were really on the very frontier. The Alaska Highway was pushed through in 42 and 43, largely to supply the military in Alaska that had come in only a couple of years before. One of the interesting things was we were the transfer point for all of the material going to Russia. This was primarily fighter planes and little attack bombers. These would be flown by American pilots to Fairbanks, to the Ladd Field, and here the transfer was made and the Russian pilots would take over, fly them from here down to Galena, on to Nome, and on to Siberia, and within a few days they were fighting on the front. And so we had Russians in town all over the streets and in our stores, and they were part of this legation, you might say, arranging the transfer of our so-called lend-lease materials. At the end of the war, of course, we had realized, the whole defense structure had realized the importance of Alaska and Fairbanks, and so these bases, Ladd Field and the Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Greely, were made into permanent structures, and so all of the temporary buildings were replaced by the more solid concrete material, and they became permanent parts of the American defense system. That provided the economy in large measure, and still does, for the interior of Alaska. Gold mining never survived the war. The ground that was able to be worked was worked for a few years after the war, but with the price of gold pegged at $35 an ounce, it's no longer economical to mine gold under the present costs of labor and materials. But taking the place in the economy then was our defense structure. The university was growing. It happened to be about our second largest employer in the vicinity of people. And of course, tourism, and thanks to you people and people like you, has become a very important part of our economy.
Supper.
And so during the 50s, it's been largely those things. Of course, we're the jumping off point. We were in the 50s for the Dew Line and the White Alice Line. And now, as you know, we're the jumping off point for the Arctic, the Purdue Bay. You've heard about the great oil discoveries on the North Slope. And so here we stand, members of the Historical Society, kind of glancing back a little bit for a few minutes into our rather interesting, I think, past history. We don't know what's on the horizon, but we have great faith in the future as far as Fairbanks is concerned. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, folks. When was the boundary established between the Yukon and the Alaska?
Offhand, I would say it was about 1905 or 6, someplace in there.
Somebody else asked what size the mining lots were. We got two stories on that.
I don't know. No. I'd know it if I gave a thought at all.
Well, we thank you very much, Professor Cashin, and we wonder, the University of Alaska isn't making a mistake. If you're half as good a professor of mathematics as you are a student of history of Alaska, you're pretty good, but I think you can do a wonderful job as a professor of history at the university. We came down from Minnesota up to Alaska. This is more or less an Aboriginal country, and we brought with us a weapon, and upon leaving here, which will be in the not too distant future, and after hearing your talk tonight, we have decided that we won't need our weapons. And listen, all of you didn't know I had this either, but I've had thoughts. But this is a trade tomahawk peace pipe, and is one, you've all heard the expression, let's bury the hatchet.
Yeah.
When we had peace. No, seriously, this is where that expression started. The traders, the Hudson's Bay Company of Canada specifically, manufactured this, and they traded them. They cost them about 14 cents in those days, and they'd trade them for $140 worth of furs. That's the way they did business. But at their peace treaties, after the treaty has been all arranged, the whites and the Indians would go out, take the tomahawk, drive it into the ground that far, and have left only the peace pipe. And that is where the expression, let's bury the hatchet, originated. So, on behalf of the Minnesota Historical Society, and in order to, in a small way, reimburse you for what you've done to us, I'd like to present to you this hatchet.
I can't say, Professor, that we want peace between Minnesota and Alaska. For goodness sakes, let's do our best.
Well, I thank you. Now, I have no prepared speech for this.
Well, that wasn't prepared
either. I tell you, we'll take good care of that, and we'll... when we run into arguments with any Minnesotans, we'll bury the hatchet.
Very well.
Thank
you.
Oh, that's very interesting. Uh-huh. Is that right? I didn't know that.
Many people don't know it, but it's true, and it's a replica of an old one. It isn't an old one.
Well, that's just amazing. Well, we thank you very much.
That's all right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this evening's program. And for those who are going to Nome, please go home and get to bed so you can get up at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.